This is Central Time. America's seafood consumption has been on the rise. Demand is expected to keep growing. In 2017, Americans ate 16 pounds of seafood per day. No, on average. I'm thinking that's per year. The highest total in 8 years. I'm just kidding. It's per year. While fish is often billed as a healthy food option, the fish industry has problems like overfishing and concerns about contaminants found in fish. For the consumer, finding fish that's both environmentally sustainable and good for consumption can seem like a challenge. But our next guests say that Wisconsin is home to many aquaculture businesses and commercial fisheries that can meet these demands. Plus, they have some recipes for us. Titus Seilheimer is the Fisheries Outreach Specialist with the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute based on the UW-Green Bay Manitowoc campus. He joins us now from our Green Bay studio. Titus, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
And Tim Campbell is the Aquatic Invasive Species Outreach Specialist with the UW Sea Grant Institute. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, Titus, there's been growing interest in supporting local businesses and local food, but fish sometimes for people is a gray area. What are some of the reasons you think that people don't think of, you know, buying Wisconsin fish, Midwestern fish to put on their table?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think sometimes people, you know, they have their go-to recipes for chicken, pork, steak, and they don't have those go-to fish recipes. And, you know, sometimes it can be a challenge to just go into your grocery store and leave with local fish. So it might take a little planning and a little extra work to make that happen.
And Tim, I think people are concerned sometimes. Let's start with the farming industry, fish farming industry in Wisconsin. There have been concerns in the past that aquaculture, fish farming has pollution concerns. It isn't sustainable. What do we know about that?
So we know that the aquaculture industry in Wisconsin is pretty well regulated, and I think Titus would be able to touch a little bit more on the specifics of some of that.
Yeah, Titus, talk about what kind of regulations we have on aquaculture here in the state.
Yeah, there. You know, the state does, you know, regulate those discharge just like any other company that might be discharging. So it's you know, a pretty high standard, and they're, you know, really looking to protect the water quality of the, you know, the waters that are receiving that discharge from the fish farm. So, you know, lots of regulations in place. Some of the farmers might say too many regulations, but, you know, at least it's protecting our local waters. So I think that's good news for the consumer, too.
And Tim, how about finding this kind of fish at the store? How can we find out who's carrying it, or if they don't, how to try to connect the shop with the producers?
So there's a handful of different ways you can find Wisconsin fish. You can go to eatwisconsinfish.org, and there should be a list of places you can buy Wisconsin-produced fish. If you have a favorite fish farm, you might be able to go to their website and see where they currently are supplying their fish to. And then, you know, an example that I have, I lived in a small town outside of Madison, and our small grocery store didn't have any Wisconsin fish, didn't even have any American fish when they first opened. So I just made a comment, let them know that there were a handful of really good Great Lakes in Wisconsin options that they could bring in to sell. And within about a month or two, they had those options available for us. And for the handful of years I lived there, that's pretty much all I bought from that store. So if you don't have it at your store, you can always request that they carry it.
Talking to Tim Campbell and Titus Seilheimer for the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, looking at the fish available around Wisconsin. We'll look at the wild-caught fish in just a bit, but you guys stepped outside of your usual roles into a chef role to help promote some Wisconsin fish. Titus, let's start with you. You've got a quick pan-fried fish with lemon butter sauce. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so, you know, really the what I wanted to do was provide something that was pretty simple with, you know, the ingredients that you might have on hand at all already. So, you know, putting together a dry rub out of brown sugar and onion powder, some other seasonings, just rubbing that on a fish and then cooking it, you know, pan fry, you can bake it, you can grill it, and really fish shouldn't be that complicated. and then, you know, adding something like a butter sauce, if your friends don't like fish or your family doesn't like fish, cover it in butter, and they will love it.
And Titus, Food Friday listeners know I'm a little timid about cooking fish because I'm scared I'm going to overcook it. How do we know when our fish is done when we're pan frying it?
You know, my secret for, you know, the perfect fish or really the perfect meat anytime is to use a thermometer and just keep an eye on that temperature. With fish, you want to go for, you know, depending on the species, somewhere between 120 and 140 degrees, and your fish will be done right.
All right. And then, Tim, hook us up with your salmon BLT now. This looks really good.
Yeah. So I had this at a brewery once, and I had this sandwich, and I knew I had to try to recreate it at home. And I think I got lucky enough in doing that, and I really like it because it's a kind of a fun way to make salmon. Maybe, you know, because I feel like a lot of times you just maybe roast it in the oven real quick and serve it with, like, potatoes and a veggie. So this is kind of maybe a fun way that you might have salmon with some friends over a beer on Friday night or something like that.
Yeah, tell us a little bit, how do we cook that salmon when we're making it?
So in the video, we oven roasted it with some bacon, added some pepper to it, and that was really it for 20 minutes. And then you just built the sandwich with a bun, avocado, lettuce, tomato, and the bacon. And a lot like making a normal BLT, just, you know, cooking a little salmon to add on there.
We've got Titus and Tim's fish recipes. You can find them at WPR.org/Central Time. Talking to two guests from the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, Titus Seilheimer, fisheries outreach specialist based on the UW-Green Bay Manitowoc campus. Tim Campbell is the aquatic invasive species outreach specialist. They're with us to talk about Wisconsin fish farmed and wild caught and giving us some inspiration for cooking them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you bought local fish, farmed or wild caught? If you're interested in buying local fish but haven't yet, what's making you hesitate? Do you have questions about how farmed fish works? And if you go out and catch those fish yourselves, I want to know your favorite way to cook it, your favorite Wisconsin freshwater fish and how you like to eat it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with two guests from the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, Titus Seilheimer and Tim Campbell. They are joining us to talk about Wisconsin fish farmed and wild caught and giving us some inspiration for cooking with them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you bought local fish to cook at home, farmed or wild caught? What was your experience with it? Were you able to find it pretty easy? Do you catch and make your cook your own fish? What's your favorite way to eat it? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Christian is with us in Racine. Christian, hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to know if your guest had any familiarity with what Superior Fresh is doing up in around the Hickston area. They have what I believe is the country's largest inland North Atlantic salmon farm-raised operation, and they're recycling all the nutrients from the fish into an aquaponics operation on site where they are growing microgreens and lettuces and herbs. It's a really, really impressive operation.
Titus, do you want to tackle that?
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, I think that is probably a large part of the future of aquaculture right there. It's, you know, reusing all that water, capturing the nutrients, growing greens, growing fish all together. It's, you know, in here in Wisconsin, producing lots of Atlantic salmon. I've been through the facility. It's a very impressive facility.
Christian, thanks for that call. And Tim, that salmon and BLT, I assume you're using Wisconsin farm-raised salmon for that one?
Yes, we actually use the Superior Fresh salmon.
Oh, that very brand. Okay.
Yep, in that video. So it's a quite delicious fish.
Can you tell the difference, Tim, in cooking between, you know, a Wisconsin salmon and something you caught, you know, in the Atlantic?
It's probably pretty difficult, but the one thing that I know that I like about, you know, getting something from a local facility in Wisconsin is that I know it's really fresh. So I think if you can tell a difference, maybe sometimes that, you know, if you get something from Wisconsin from a producer, you know that, you know, it was freshly processed and produced, where maybe sometimes if you caught something, if it's not eaten right away, it could have been in the freezer and have some quality issues there.
Christian, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Anita joins us now in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hello.
Hi. I have a question for your host. Before that, I will tell you we mostly eat wild-caught salmon, Arctic char, and catfish. And we eat probably more than what you said per year. And we have our favorite way of fixing it. We love fish. Here's the thing. It's really puzzling us. We live in what they call the Chain of Lakes area in northern Illinois, And you can see any old guys with their little lawn chairs down by the river. They catch catfish by the dozen, no problem. You cannot buy wild-caught catfish, though. It only can come through farms. And when it's kind of pricey, considering it's such a, you know, it's a lower-level fish, but we really like it. And we're trying to figure out, why can't you get wild-caught catfish when I can go down to the river and get it?
Anita, thanks for the call. Maybe you that'll be your big break in business, Anita. I don't know. Tim, when you're out hunting for fish at the stores, do you tend to see local catfish?
I think it would depend on how you define local. I don't know if I've seen any Wisconsin catfish, but I am a fan of U.S.-raised catfish. That is something that I'll buy and cook in our house when it's available.
And Titus, do we have any kind of catfish industry going on in the state?
Not really. I mean, there is a small commercial fishery in the Mississippi River, and they may be catching some catfish there. I'm not really as familiar with that, but it would be, you know, probably more available locally. And, you know, really nationally, the you know, farm-raised catfish in the U.S. Has to compete with a lot of imported catfish as well. So it can be a challenge for domestic U.S. producers to compete with some of those prices.
And Titus, I wanted to ask you about the wild fishery industry in Wisconsin. I saw a video where you talk about it. It's, in many cases, kind of a small family business operation.
Yeah, so Wisconsin has a long history of Great Lakes commercial fishing, you know, goes back to the 1800s and really before that. As long as people have been in Wisconsin for hundreds, if not thousands of years, they've been catching fish out of the Great Lakes. And, you know, currently our commercial fisheries are fairly small. They're really mainly focused on Lake Whitefish. But it's a family business. And, you know, that's another way to get some local fish is to go to your local fish market if you live near the coast. And, you know, you could probably buy whitefish caught by that fisherman out on the Great Lakes.
Let's take one more caller. Carlene is with us in Lodi. Carlene, hello.
Hello. Hi there. I just wanted to make a quick comment. My husband and I try to fish a lot in the summer in the Madison Lakes and or the Wisconsin River, and we love catfish out of the river too. So when I find a brine and then we smoke it, our old-fashioned smoker we've had for 30-some years.
Wow. Anything else apart from catfish, Carlene?
Just small panfish, white bass, you know, stuff like that. We use I used to use a breading called Mr. Walleye. I can't find it anymore, and there's another one too, but I can't, you know, find it either. So I kind of make up my own with flour and some seasoning and then fry it up in bacon grease.
All right. I'll zoom over for dinner after the show. Carlene, thanks for the call. Tim, you want to leave us with any advice? You speaking of bacon, you had that bacon salmon BLT. Do you like to try to experiment with your fish, try new and different recipes?
Yeah, I just really love cooking with fish, which is why I was part of the video, even though it has really nothing to do with my job. But I think you can, if you have a favorite recipe, I think you can sub fish into a lot of different things. I really like making a salmon or a lake trout curry, which is maybe a little bit different than what you might normally have. But I think just if you perfect cooking a fish a certain way, like pan frying it or roasting it, you can really place it into a bunch of different recipes and have a lot of different uses for your fish, and that you can incorporate more fish into your diet that way.
Fantastic. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And Titus, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Titus Seilheimer, Fisheries Outreach Specialist at the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, based on the UW-Green Bay Manitowoc campus. Tim Campbell, also with us, the Aquatic Invasive Species Outreach Specialist at the UW-Sea Grant Institute. They both joined us to talk about Wisconsin fish, farmed and wild caught. You can find their recipes, salmon BLT and pan-fried fish with lemon butter sauce, at WPR.org/Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. It can be tough to keep a restaurant open. You may have seen in your community restaurants, they might come and go if you're in a small town, big town, wherever. The Wisconsin Small Business Development Center is partnering with people around the state to offer some lessons in pretty much everything related to running a restaurant, getting started, managing menus, staffing, and more. Jason Schleip is lead consultant on the SBDC's Restaurant Initiative. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what kind of consulting services is this initiative going to offer to would-be restaurant owners?
Well, it'll offer basically everything, kind of a full package from start to finish. So we'll help them. You know, we'll help prospective restaurant owners open a business, help them, you know, with their financials and getting their kind of their menu in line and getting their product in line. And then we can help current restaurant owners who are maybe struggling a little bit and want to fix like certain areas of their operation, can help them maybe, you know, get their menu a little better, help them with some cost of goods sold, maybe help them with some labor issues. And then we can actually help people transitioning out of the restaurant industry too. If they want to put their place for sale, we can help them, you know, get their books in order and get that going.
As a business, I've heard, I don't know if this is true, that restaurants have a really high turnover. What are some of the unique challenges in getting a restaurant up and running successfully?
Well, right now, and you're completely right, they do have a high turnover. And one of the reasons we started this initiative is because that turnover is getting higher in the state of Wisconsin. And a unique challenge is currently, first of all, there's a lot of competition. It's, you know, anytime we're in boom times like this with great, you know, great economy and things like that, a lot of places pile in, and the competition's tough, so you got to stand out. Second of all, and in conjunction with that, the labor market's super tough right now. So starting a new restaurant and building a staff is something that's really hard to do.
A lot of people might think of this as a city thing. You know, restaurants, cities have a lot of restaurants. I understand you're working, or your organization's working with rural areas and small towns, too, in particular.
Yeah, we are. When we set it up, the main focus was going to be on the rural areas because they seem to be the ones that struggle the most and maybe kind of see the least amount of help. So, but we, you know, we're not going to discriminate. We'll help anybody in any area, but, you know, we do want to target the rural areas.
If someone's listening and thinking, yeah, I am a restaurant owner, or I'm just starting up, or wow, it's been tough lately, how do they get involved in this?
Well, first of all, just go to our website. It's the SBDC of Wisconsin website, and there's a special spot on there for the restaurants. If you Google SBDC Wisconsin /restaurants, you'll find it. And then you can sign up, send us an email, it'll come to me, and then I'll contact you.
I think a lot of people might have had the thought, oh, I'm a pretty good cook. I could open up a restaurant. Can you talk about some of the things that may be surprises to them if they pursued that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a lot of people get into that situation. I'm a good cook. I can open up a restaurant. I would say cooking and opening up a restaurant, cooking is probably 10% of it, right? You know, you actually have to be a really good people manager. You have to have some good business skills. You have to be able to take ups and downs because the restaurant industry never goes in a straight line. You have to be resilient in handling those ups and downs. And, you know, you have to also be able to work long hours and unusual hours. You can't be set in your schedule or there's just no chance you're going to make it.
All right. Here's a question that always baffles me among the many reasons I will never open a restaurant. You have to buy these ingredients, many of them perishable, and you don't know who's going to order the chicken tonight or who's going to order whatever else. You don't know which of these perishable ingredients you need at any given night.
Yeah, that's true. And the way to combat that is you just plan your menu correctly so that you're not having a lot of random items that you have to order that might go bad. You know, the items that you do order that should go can go bad, you want to be able to use in maybe 5 to 10 different dishes so that, you know, you can kind of cover it there. You know, and if you do have a special dish on there that takes a few items that other dishes don't, you know, just get something that's not going to be perishable.
Is this the kind of logistical advice you might give as a consultant in this program?
Yeah. You know, we'll ask questions and we'll also go over people's books and figure out and kind of go over their menu and figure out maybe that is something they're doing wrong, you know, that affects their bottom line.
How does this end up benefiting a local economy if they have thriving restaurants?
Well, so especially in the rural areas and the small town, you know, a lot of small towns now are revitalizing their downtown and they really want people to come visit them. And can you imagine a small town that didn't have a restaurant option? You know, they want people to come and stay a day, you know, and shop and explore the local things to do. And if you don't have a place to go for lunch or dinner, you're not going to stay there. You're going to come for an hour or two and go maybe back to the larger town where there's more options. So we really need to keep these small towns with at least one or two really good dining options.
You've got this initiative. How are you going to measure its success?
Well, we have certain metrics we have to hit. The main thing is just getting it going this year, getting it going, getting the knowledge out there, getting a few different areas served, and the main thing is we're going to measure success by just how many people we can serve. And it's a 3-year program as of now, and we're hoping it can continue after that.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Schleip, lead consultant for the Wisconsin Small Business Development Center's Restaurant Initiative. We talked to him today about a new effort aimed at helping small restaurants with their long-term business goals. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum answering a Why Scotson question about public radio music.
As a public radio listener, you're probably familiar with this song. The All Things Considered theme has had a few variations over the decades, but did you know it was originally composed in Madison, Wisconsin in the 1970s? The song was written by Don Vegley, the longtime music director at WHA, which would become Wisconsin Public Radio. Vegley had been composing original music for WHA for decades. That's why, nearly 50 years ago, he was tapped by colleagues to write the theme song for NPR's first show, All Things Considered.
Bum, bum, bing, bum, 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 ba-dee-dum, right?
That's Vegley on NPR in 1977. He composed a lot of music in his office at WPR. His instrument of choice at that time? Synthesizers.
I now have some additional instruments that I crutch on. Fender Rhodes piano, an arp string instrument. I have a Polymoog.
There's a photo of Vegley hanging up in WPR's hallway. He's dressed in a dapper plaid jacket in his studio, just down the hall from my office.
And he's standing in front of this impressive bank of synthesizers.
That's Nigel O'Shea, a technical director at WPR, who passes that photo nearly every day. He's thought a lot about Vegley, and more specifically, the synthesizers in that photo.
And since I started working here, I've always wondered, where did those go?
These synthesizers and pianos helped create some of the most iconic sounds and film music in public radio. To O'Shea, the gear represents something more than just instruments.
He had this self-contained music factory, like right here in our building, to do all of our interstitials and our music beds and all that type of thing.
This was unique for the time. In fact, Vegley provided this music free to radio stations across the country. His son, Jim Vegley, explains.
He produced lots of music over 5 decades, and he played the organ interstitials in Studio A. He played piano, and they got small ensembles to play for College of the Air and School of the Air productions, some of which were nationally distributed.
In the final decade of his career, Vegley transitioned to synthesizers. Why make the switch?
It was kind of the cutting-edge sound of its time.
And while this new technology took time for some listeners to get used to, Vegley continued to crank out a ton of music from his electrosonic studio. O'Shea says Vegley did this to keep things affordable.
He was trying to make music in-house, but to do that without hiring a bunch of musicians and setting up recording sessions.
So we have these synthesizers that are really important in the history of public radio, music, and Wisconsin. And we have no clue where they are. They're not sitting around WPR anymore. Where did they go? Well, O'Shea and I went on a treasure hunt to track them down, and it was not easy. When Vegley retired in 1982, WHA auctioned his equipment off. There are no records of these instruments anywhere. But O'Shea and I know we're looking for a Putney, a Moog, and probably a few other instruments. Hidden treasure number one, the Putney synthesizer. The Putney is the nickname given to Electronic Music Studios VCS3. This portable rig was created in the late 1960s and was beloved by many bands, perhaps most famously, The Who and Pink Floyd. The Putney. Vegley composed NPR's first All Things Considered theme on it. We heard a rumor it had been purchased by someone in Madison, but when we went to find it...
Yeah, I knew the guy.
Did
yeah.
you?
Yeah, not well.
Okay.
But I don't have any of this stuff.
A dead end. Next, we're on the hunt for another synthesizer, the Moog. The Moog synthesizer was unveiled in the mid-1960s. One of its most famous early appearances was on the Beatles' Abbey Road. We heard a rumor that Vegley's Moog went to the UW School of Music, so we went to investigate.
This is one of the original
earliest Moog synthesizers.
The school has a Moog stashed in storage, but when we looked more closely...
Do you see a serial number on it?
Oh, look at this. Let's see.
We struck out again. This was not Vegli's Moog. There had to be other synthesizers out there, but where were they? Remember that auction I mentioned earlier? The one where Vegli's synthesizers were sold off after he retired? We found someone who took part in it. Tom Nonis leads O'Shea and me down to the basement in his Madison home.
This is my electronic music studio, and I've been doing electronic music since 1973.
For a few decades, Nonis worked as a music composer and sound designer for WHA-TV, now known as PBS Wisconsin. After Vegli retired in 1982, Nonis was given a sheet of paper listing Vegli's equipment.
There was a list of the different pieces that were going up, so it was a silent auction.
Nonis bid about $300 on two synthesizers.
The winners were announced. This is what I got.
Vegli's Arp Quadra. The other, an Arp Soloist. For Nonis, owning Vegli's synthesizers is really special.
When I think about his classic tune, do-do-do-do, having heard that and then going and meeting the man who had created it and seeing where he had created it, it was inspirational. I am indebted to him, really.
Nonis says Vegli paved the way for him to have a meaningful dream job, creating music for public broadcasting. Don Vegli did more than impact one person's career. The songs he created helped set the tone in public media across the country. For O'Shea, he'd like to see more stations create positions for the future Don Veglis of the world. With the rise in podcasting, O'Shea says there's room for more experimentation.
I just kind of hope that maybe in the radio community we can get back to that DIY or self-made kind of model, where we're not looking for canned, already produced stuff, but we're actually making it ourselves.
Don Vegli passed away in 2009. He would have turned 100 years old this month. So, if any of you out there know where any of Don Vegli's synthesizers are, please let us know so we can solve this musical mystery. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll recap today's State of the Tribes address and look at some of the issues facing Wisconsin's Native American communities. Right now, Judith Sears-Poisson joins me in the studio for the Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Member Drive. You count on the Ideas Network for great discussions. It's your gift of any amount that makes them possible. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we have just a few minutes left in this hour. I am going to be honest. We have met our goal, which is awesome. There will be some hours where we don't. So please give now. You give now. You won't have to think about it the rest of the drive. You can give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Great example of the kind of things you get from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sure, the conversations we bring you every day on the Ideas Network, but great pieces from Wisconsin Life and why Wisconsin, like the one we just heard, a mystery near and dear to the hearts of, I think, any longtime public radio fan. Those synthesizers, love to have one of them myself, actually. That'd be fun to play with. I'd probably tell Maureen about it, though, solve the mystery if I had it, but I don't. But this is the example of the kind of conversations and pieces you can count on here on the Ideas Network.
WPR is listener supported. That means that your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. So choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
And get the brand new WPR winter hat. It's warm. It's cool looking. It has an awesome pom-pom on the top. It's USA made here in Wisconsin, actually. Support the programs you value and show off your WPR pride wherever you go. Starts with your gift of $20 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I would say that if you really enjoy public radio and you listen to it even occasionally, if it does something to enlighten you on a certain point of view, then that is value. That's valuable. But nothing in life that is of value is truly free. Being a sustaining member, even if you just donate a small amount each month, you know, what it would cost you for a cup of coffee is really, really worth it if you believe in what they're doing. And I do. I'm John from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me in sustaining Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can do that online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Central Time, Rob Ferret here with Judith Sears-Poisson. Listener support is the biggest source of funding for all the WPR programs you rely on. That's why your support during this membership drive is so important. Whether you give 10 bucks a month or 100, whatever amount you choose is the right amount to give.
You know, our world gets more complex all the time, and it can be harder and harder to make sense of it all. You rely on the Ideas Network to turn complicated issues and the news of the day into understandable language so you know how they'll affect you.
For you to get programs that are relevant to your life, we count on your financial support. It's the biggest source of our funding. That's why we ask that if you've never given before, make your first ever contribution now, maybe 10 bucks a month or $120 during this winter membership drive at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Take a moment and think about what you spend money on every day. Maybe it's coffee, lunch out, a snack, music. It all adds up. It's easy to spend on things that are part of your routine.
Wisconsin Public Radio is part of your routine, too. It's your news source, your conversation starter, your place to learn, your place to have people chatter in the background so you feel like you got some company in the car. Spend some money on it today. Start with a buck a day, maybe 30 bucks a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.